Welcome to Shiur in Svarno, Parsha Shoftim. In his comments to the beginning of Parsha Shoftim, the Svarno writes that Achar HaMitzvos LeHamon, after in Parsha Sre'e, the Torah has shared mitzvos that apply to everyone in Klal Yisrael, Tziva Inyanei Manhigov. So now at this point, the beginning of Parsha Shoftim, the Torah is now switching its focus a little bit, is going to talk about halachas that pertain to the manhigim, to the leaders of Klal Yisrael. V'heim ha-shoftim, so this applies to the judges, which is the discussion at the beginning of Parsha Shoftim. V'ha-melochim, the Torah that in Parsha Shoftim, in Perek Yud Zayin, moves on to talk about the halachas of the melech, of the king. V'ha-kohanim, it then moves on after that to talk about halachas that pertain to kohanim. V'ha-neviim, and then after that, it begins to talk about neviim, about prophets. So in other words, right in Parsha Shoftim, there are four distinct roles of leadership, judges, kings, kohanim, and prophets, whose halachas are all dealt with. In other words, to put it a little bit differently, Parsha Shoftim, according to the Svarno, is a parsha that deals with mitzvos that pertain to the leadership. Asher b'tikunam yisukan inyan ha-hamon. If the leadership does what it's supposed to do, so then that has a positive impact on the masses. Uvekilkulam yakulkal. And if, conversely, the leadership is corrupt or not doing the right thing, so that's going to have a trickle-down effect to the populace as well. So that's an introduction that kind of puts the parsha as a whole into a certain context and helps us frame a little bit what's going to be discussed in these next couple of prokim. That introduction actually sets the mood for a comment of the Svarno that extends over a number of psukim, which I think it's a very beautiful comment, and we'll see how it fits into the idea that Parsha Shoftim is really about halachas that pertain to the leadership. So there's a famous, after introducing the idea that we're supposed to have shoftim v'shotrim, that we're supposed to have judges and policemen to enforce the rules of the judges. So of course, Pasuk Yutes goes on to tell us a little bit about how the judges are supposed to conduct justice. Lo satem mishpat, lo sakir panim. Don't pervert justice. Don't show favoritism. Velo sikach shochad. Don't take bribes. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof, justice, justice shall you pursue. Okay, so those are all halachas or statements that pertain to shoftim, that pertain to dayanim, to judges. But then, the next three psukim seem to have nothing to do with judges. In Perek Tezayin, Pasuk Chof Aleph, we read, Lo sita lecha ashera kol eitz, you should not plant any kind of Asherah tree, a certain kind of tree that was worshipped as Avodah Zarah. Eitz al mizbeach Hashem Elokecha asher ta'aseh lach. Don't plant any such tree next to the mizbeach, next to the altar of Hashem. V'lo sakim lecha matzeva asher sonei Hashem Elokecha. Don't set up a monument, a stone, which was used as a vehicle for worship. HaKadosh Baruch Hu hates the institution of the matseva, using the matseva as a way of worshiping. And finally, lo sizbach l'Hashem Elokecha shor voseh asher yiyeh bo mum. Don't offer up as a korban any kind of animal that has a blemish in it. So it's striking that these psukim seem to really come out of nowhere and don't really fit in, certainly not with the general rubric of that the Svarno has developed, that all of these halachas that are at the beginning of the parasha deal with shoftim, deal with judges and how they're supposed to judge things. But they're also like little snippets that are very, unconnected to broader halachas. Okay, so the Torah just told us, for instance, that you're not supposed to plant an Asherah tree or worship at a matseva. Those halachas would have been more relevant when the Torah was discussing different types of avodah zarah. How it seems like just very random that they're placed over here. And then when the Torah goes on to say, don't offer up a karbon that has a mum, that has a blemish, that was something that was discussed earlier in the Chumash at length. And it's repetition over here in such short and terse terms also just seems out of place and doesn't really add anything, seemingly, to what the Torah is trying to lay out over here. So we'll see, the Svarno beautifully links together these psukim with the whole idea of judges, and he makes the following comment. This is on Pasuk Chof. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Right, famous pasuk. Justice, justice shall you pursue. So even though it's poetic to repeat the word justice twice, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, it's not immediately obvious what the repetition of the word tzedek, justice, accomplishes. Tzedek, tirdof, you should pursue justice. What's tzedek, tzedek? The guy had a stutter. What does it mean that you're pursuing justice, justice? What, other than sounding poetic, what's implied by that? So here the Svarno writes the following very beautiful idea. Kishatitein l'cha shoftim. The Torah over here in saying tzedek tzedek tirdof is not addressing the judges themselves. The Torah is addressing the selection committee who's selecting the judges. So when you're looking to select judges, ata hamemana es hashoftim, b'charis hayoser shoftei tzedek. When you look for a judge, look for a judge who's as qualified a justice as you could possibly find, which wouldn't seem to be that much of a chiddush, a novel idea. I mean, after all, you know, obviously if you're looking for someone to fill a position, you'd like to try to find the most qualified person to fill the position. So what's the chiddush? Afal pi she'ein bohem kol kach she'or tachsisim horu'uyim ledayon kemo shleimus hakinyon u'shleimus haguf. Look for the person who will do the best job as a judge, even if in terms of certain other physical attributes that person is lacking. What does that mean? So you may be inclined, in a vacuum, you'd like to get a judge who's a person of wealth and prestige. Now, why would you want that? Well, the truth is, it's nice, but besides the fact that it's nice, it also will enhance his ability to judge fairly. If he's wealthy, that means that, you know, the bribe doesn't mean all that much to him. And if he's a person of prestige, that means, you know, in certain cases, that he'll be able to enforce his verdicts or have his verdicts listened to, where, you know, a person of lesser prestige maybe would be brushed aside by some of the litigants. So maybe in a vacuum, you'd like to have a person who's not only known for his erudition as a judge, but somebody who's wealthy, who's a person of prestige, who's a person who's physically striking. You know, when the judge walks in and all rise, and the guy's, you know, 6'10", makes a certain impression. You know, if Nebuch, the guy is 5'2", so maybe it doesn't make quite the same kind of impression. You know, so there's something to be said in a vacuum for having a judge who not only has erudition as a judge, but also has certain non-judicial qualities which you might think would add to his position. So to that comes the Pasuk and says, in the end of the day, what matters most is his erudition. And that's what it means, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Pursue justice in picking a judge, even if that comes at the expense of other things. Okay, so he's not so physically striking. He may even be handicapped, right? He may even not have shleimus haguf. He may not have perfection of the body, in the words of the Svarno. You say, okay, you know, this hunchbacked judge, maybe he's not, you know, people are going to look at him, they're going to dismiss what he has to say, you know, they'll see him as being handicapped, and therefore they'll say that he's not a person, you know, of prestige that we should listen to. You know, again, Baruch Hashem, we live in a society where those who are physically handicapped we try to integrate them into society to the greatest extent. But the truth is, that's only a couple of generations old, you know. I mean, we think back, to a president of the United States who sought to hide the fact that he had polio and, was confined to a wheelchair. He didn't want to share that with the American people. Why? Because people thought, you know, if he's a president who's handicapped, that will diminish his prestige. People are not going to listen to him anymore. right? So even a few generations ago, you know, the notion that a person has a physical handicap would be looked at as, you know, not allowing them to advance in society in the best possible way. Comes the Sfarno and he says, when you're picking a judge, forget about the fact that he's physically handicapped. And forget about the fact that he doesn't have 2 cents to rub together. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. When you're looking to pick the judge, pick the person who's as erudite and as committed to justice as possible, irrespective of the fact that he has, quote-unquote, these other flaws that would otherwise hold him back as a judge. Right, so it's interesting. So in the Kohen, we do demand physical perfection, at least in order to bring bring avoda. So again, ultimately, it's gzeres hakosuf. In other words, the fact that there by a Kohen, the fact that he's a baal mum disqualifies him is gzeres hakosuf of the Torah. But perhaps, you know, there. Look, the truth is, other than the fact that you have the lineage of a Kohen, you don't need any special mental qualifications, you know, to be a Kohen. If they tell you what to do, and you do it, you carry it out. When it comes to a judge, you know, the person has to be endowed with a certain amount of wisdom, and that's a hard thing to come by. So if you've got to restrict the guy even further and say that he can't be physically handicapped, you may end up compromising on the wisdom of the judge, and that's not a place you really want to compromise. You know, you don't want to have a very handsome, good-looking judge who doesn't know what he's talking about, right? So maybe that's the distinction between Dayanim and Kohanim. Al Kopanim, yeah. Well, there also, I mean, l'chatchilo, Yisro advised Moshe Rabbeinu, try to get people who are, you know, people of means, who are not going to be able to be susceptible to bribes. But the Sfarno is basically saying, if you have to, you know, we don't live in a perfect world, you're not going to be able to find anyone who necessarily has all of the attributes. It would be wonderful, he's saying, it would be wonderful if you could get a person who is very impressive physically and has wealth, you know, and is not easily able to be bribed. But if that comes at the expense of his ability to be a judge, you know, the basic ability, the basic qualification, it's not worth it. You know, better to get the best judge you can possibly get, even if in other respects he's lacking. So that's tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. So using that idea, the Sfarno then goes into the next three psukim that seemingly have nothing to do with judges. The idea that we can't plant an Asherah next to the Mizbeach, the idea that we can't worship at a matseva, at a monument, and the idea that a karbon can't have a mum, can't have a blemish, and, you know, he uses those psukim to illustrate this idea that the shofet, that the judge, you know, has to, you know, the best judge is the person who is best qualified to be the judge, even if he lacks some of the exterior things which otherwise might be desirable. And he goes as follows. Lo sita lecha asherah kol eitz. Hevi shlosha domim me'inyan dvarim sheim noim kefi achush v'nim osim ibnei mumam haruchni. The Torah goes on to bring three examples of things that aesthetically strike us as pleasing, but anyone with a spiritual sense finds them disgusting. What are these things? Rishona hi ha'ashera, shehi l'noi hechalos, umikol makom hi nimeses la'kodesh, b'mnei shehi tachsis la'avodazara. Consider the example of the Ashera, says the Sfarno. What's the Ashera? The Ashera is a tree which is planted near an altar and which becomes a source of veneration. Now, why would the Torah single out the Ashera out of all the different types of avodazara? They're all types, all kinds of avodah zarah which are prohibited. Why talk about the asherah? The answer is, says the Sfarno, the asherah is beautiful. I mean, if you think about it in a vacuum, you know, think about, for a moment, Japanese gardens, you know, where the garden itself could be set up as a place of prayer. You know, to have trees, to have foliage in a place of prayer, in a place that's next to a mizbeach, next to an altar, It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's inspiring, right? You would think that planting the Asherah next to the Mizbeach is something amazing, is something beautiful. It's aesthetically pleasing. Nonetheless, comes the Torah and says, even though this thing, this tree, is aesthetically pleasing, you can't bring the Asherah into the place where the Mizbeach is, into the place where the where the altar is, because it may be beautiful and aesthetically pleasing, but it's also something connected with Avodah Zarah. Not everything which is beautiful and aesthetically pleasing is desirable. And in fact, we know lahalacha that the Gemara says that for this reason, because you're not allowed to plant an Asherah next to the Mizbeach, not only can you not plant an Asherah tree, which is actually Avodah Zarah by the Mizbeach, but you're not supposed to use wood next to the Mizbeach at all. You can't plant trees in the Beis HaMikdash or even use wood in parts of the Beis HaMikdash. And some poskim went so far as to say you can't even plant trees in the shul. Right, there's Rabbi Akiva Eiger who says that, you know, since the shul is a mikdash ma'at, even planting a tree, let's say you had, there used to be a famous shul in Brooklyn, actually, there was a tree that was growing right in the middle of the Beis Medrash. So obviously they didn't hold like that, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Let's say you wanted to have a shul, especially, you know, you have an outdoors shul, it's kind of on a patio or something like that. You want to plant trees around the periphery of the shul. Rabbi Akiva Eiger says you can't do that. Right? In other words, it's too close to bringing the trees, which were sometimes worshipped as Avodah Zarah, into the vicinity of the Mikdash Ma'at. Not everybody holds that way. But there is such a concept. So just because something is beautiful doesn't mean that it's necessarily good. V'chein nakdim hadofas hatzedek haruchni l'shleimus guf hadayin shuchushi v'gashmi. The same is true when it comes to the physical appearance of this dayim. You have a judge who's not handicapped. In fact, he's very impressive physically. But not everyone who's so impressive physically is necessarily impressive spiritually. The same way the tree may be beautiful, but sometimes putting it next to the Mizbeach makes things worse from a spiritual perspective. What's beautiful spiritually, what's beautiful physically don't always go together. And in this regard, the Sfarno a little bit earlier quotes what the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Shmuel Hanavi, when Shmuel Hanavi is sent to the house of Yishai and told that one of Yishai's sons is going to be anointed to be the next Melech Yisrael. He meets the oldest son and he sees a person who's very physically impressive, and Shmuel thinks to himself, this is the one. This is obviously the one who's going to be picked to be the next Melech Yisrael. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Al tabet el mar'ehu v'al givoa komoso. Don't look at how handsome he is. Don't look at how tall and impressive he is. He's not the one. Who's the one in the house of Yishai who ultimately becomes the king? David, who was a shepherd boy, who wasn't even brought out by Yishai, but when he brought the rest of his sons to meet with Shmuel Hanavi. Just because somebody is impressive physically doesn't necessarily mean that they're impressive spiritually. That's what the Torah is trying to tell us with the Asherah. It's not so much about the Asherah itself. It's using the example of the Asherah to teach us about a dayan. Sheinis ha-matseva. The second thing that the Torah tells us about is that you're not supposed to worship at a matseva, at a monument. She'af al-pi she'hoysel erotzon kodem matan Torah. Now, the truth is, prior to matan Torah, the matseva was a vehicle for worshiping Hashem, which was common. The Pasuk says at the end of Mishpatim, Shtei Mesrei Matseva, that before Matan Torah, they set up, the Klal Yisrael, set up 12 monuments to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So as recently as right before Matan Torah, they were still worshiping at Matsevos. We certainly know that Yaakov Avinu set up a Matseva after he had the dream with the Sulam, with the ladder. The Matseva was a time-honored way of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Vizeh, what was the idea of the matseva? Ki hoya inyana ki ilu amakriv nitzav tamid lifnei hakodesh. The idea of the matseva was to convey the idea that the person worshipping at the matseva was always standing in the presence of Hashem. And he quotes the pasuk, Shivisi Hashem lenegdi samid, I've placed Hashem in front of me always. Matseva, the word itself, you know, matseva is related to the word nitzav, which means to be standing. So just as the matseva is a piece of rock which is standing up, so too that's meant to convey the idea that the person, the worshiper, is always standing in the presence of Hashem. So it's a beautiful idea. How come the matseva went out of favor? So writes the Svarno, v'naflu mizos hamadrego be'inyan ha'egel. The Klal Yisrael were prohibited from using the matseva as a way of worshiping Hashem after the Chet HaEgel, after the sin of the golden calf. Ka'amro sham kilo ela bekir b'cha. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu, after the Chet HaEgel, I will no longer go in your midst. Now here we see a very interesting idea from the Svarno, which is unique to the Svarno, but it also ties into certain ideas that he shared earlier in Chumash. How come Klal Yisrael stopped using the Matseva as a form of worshipping HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So Rashi writes over here, on the Pasuk, Asher Sonei Hashem Elokecha, that Hashem hates the Matseva, Afal Pi Shehoisa Ahuva Lo Bimei HaAvos, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu loved the institution of the Matseva during the time of the Avos, Achshav Sineya, now God hates it. Why? Me'achar Shasa'u Eilu Chok L'Avodah Zara. Because the non-Jews took over the Matseva, they used it in a way that was associated with Avodah Zara, with idolatry, and now since the non-Jews co-opted it, it's now prohibited to Jews. Which is a very interesting idea, and it raises a lot of questions. It kind of relates to something we were speaking about last week. So, I mean, let's do a theoretical over here. So let's say that tomorrow morning, you know, the Pope gets up and he says, you know, I enjoy wearing yarmulkes. All Catholics should wear yarmulkes. All Catholics should wear yarmulkes. All right? You know, so, you know, all the dioceses make an emergency call, you know, to all of the Hebrew bookstores in Flatbush. They order out all the yarmulkes that they could possibly find. And look, from tomorrow on, all the Catholics are wearing yarmulkes. So what does that mean? So we're going to stop wearing yarmulkes. Is that going to happen? I don't know.
Go to Black Hats.
What's that?
We'll go to Black Hats.
I guess so, yeah. But what's gonna happen then when they move to Black Hats? We're really going to be stuck. You know? I mean, Shreimach, I mean, whatever. We'll be put out of business, you know? So yeah, is that how it works? So every time, you know, the non-Jewish world adapts a certain thing as an expression of their religion, so that automatically becomes prohibited to us? So we actually saw last week with the Ramban and the Svarno, there is such an idea, but how far does that go? So Rashi seems to suggest that's the reason that we don't use the Matseva anymore. The Matseva used to be a form of Jewish worship. Now the non-Jewish world adapted it at some time after the giving of the Torah. The non-Jewish world adapted it as a way of worshiping their gods, their idols. So now we don't use it anymore. Now, in fact, it's despicable in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Asher Sonei Hashem Elokecha. So the Svarno is a different take. The Svarno doesn't relate the prohibition of the Matseva to the fact that it was adopted by the non-Jewish world. He says it has to do with a change within Klal Yisrael. Why is that? What does the Matseva represent? So we just saw the Svarno says the Matseva represents that I'm constantly in the presence of God, right? Shivisi Hashem l'negdi somid. So the fact that I'm constantly in the presence of God didn't change after the Chet HaEgel. You know, we're always constantly in the presence of God. Shivisi Hashem l'negdi somid was said by David HaMelech, who lived after the Chet HaEgel. But what did change after the Chet HaEgel, according to the Svarno, is that I no longer have the ability to access God in the same way in every single place. The Svarno had said that before the Chet HaEgel, there was no need for a Mishkan, no need for a Beis HaMikdash. You could access HaKadosh Baruch Hu equally anywhere you were. After the Chet HaEgel, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, you're no longer on the Madrega, on the level to be able to do that. Now, there's certain places where you can access HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a greater extent. Outside of those places, you can access HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a lesser extent. So the Matseva, symbolizing the idea that I always have unfettered access to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, wherever I am, the Matseva represented a state that Klal Yisrael had prior to the Chet HaEgel. After the Chet HaEgel, the Matseva didn't make sense for Klal Yisrael anymore because it represented a state of spirituality which they no longer had.
Well,
Oh, so what does it mean that Hashem hates it? So Hashem hates it because it's a reminder of the fact that Klal Yisrael no longer, they gave up that Madrega. In other words, it's almost spiteful. It's like the Ma'apilim. I told you not to go into Eretz Yisrael, and you don't care, you're going to go in anyway. Something like that. In other words, you know, if you had this Madrega where you could access Hashem anywhere, and you gave it up, and now you're using that vehicle which symbolizes I can access Hashem anywhere, you're lying. You're lying. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks at that. He hates the fact that you're misrepresenting the Madrega, the spiritual Madrega that you're on. So that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu prohibited the Matzeva. Again, a very unique approach of the Svarno, different from the approach of Rashi. Yeah?
Is it incorrect to say that Hashem could be accessed anywhere?
Well, not to the same extent, right? In other words, we understand that there's something about coming to shul that gives you a certain kind of access that you wouldn't necessarily have outside of shul. There's something to be said for coming to shul, mm-hmm. right? And by the same token, there's something to be said for coming to the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah. There's a certain manifestation of God there. Again, God is everywhere, but we can access HaKadosh Baruch Hu more readily in certain places than we can in other places. So, yeah.
Did I mishear you? Other than take the ego, who permanently impaired our relationship with Matzeva? Did you also mention that the Goyim started using Matzeva, and that also affected our ability to use Matzeva?
So those are two different explanations. So Rash... Right, correct.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Right. So they're two different explanations, right? They're not part of the same explanation, right?
So,
yeah.
So what is the Svarno's take on the deficiency of the Matzeva?
Right. So the Matzeva represents that we could access Hashem anywhere, and that was a level we had prior to the Chet HaEgel. We no longer have that after the Chet HaEgel, so as the Matzeva becomes prohibited. What's that got to do with the Dayan? Again, this is all the Svarno bringing this back to, you know, the qualifications for a Dayan. So he says, V'chein yikre b'inyin zokein she'ein pirko no'e she'yotza alav shem rabbi alduso k'shetimsa zokein u'pirko no'e. The lesson that we're supposed to take from the fact that the Matzeva is prohibited is the following. Look for a judge who not only is erudite and well-respected now, but someone who also, you know, has been well-respected since childhood. Sometimes you have a guy who, had a wild youth. You know, everybody says, that guy's your rabbi. Oh, boy. Yeah, we were in yeshiva together. Ooh, yeah. We got stories. Yeah, right? So, you know, you have a guy who had a wild youth, and then he kind of straightened out down the line, right? So ideally, it would be good to get someone who not only has an exemplary present, but had an exemplary past in his youth as well. What does that have to do with the Matzeva? The youth of Klal Yisrael, their failure to behave properly at the Chet HaEgel, damaged their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu permanently. So we see that youthful transgressions can leave a permanent imprint. So even when it comes to a person, look for somebody who's not only good now, but somebody who was good back in the day. That's a lesson that we're supposed to take away in terms of the search for a Dayan. The third lesson, Be'ezus Hashem, about the animal that has a mum, Be'ezus Hashem, we'll see that tomorrow when we pick up. Okay,